This is Angelie Grantham. I'm here with Oscar Peñaranda in San Francisco, California. This interview is taking place on August 11th, 2018, and it's part of the NN Cannery History Project. Oscar, could you begin by talking about when and where you were born and how it is, what it is that brought you to Alaska Salmon Canneries?
I was born in the Philippines in the island of Leyte, and when I was 5 years old, we moved to Manila, the capital city, where we lived till I was 12. And then when I was 12, after the sixth grade, we left the Philippines and immigrated to Vancouver the first 5 years, 1956 to 1961, and then San Francisco, 1961 onwards. And we've been here pretty much ever since. Yeah. Yeah, I left when I was, after the sixth grade, I left, we left the Philippines and migrated to Canada, and then in 1961 to San Francisco, and we've been here pretty much ever since. I got into Alaska because my father was in the Foreign Service, so I was a diplomat's dependent, I was a diplomat's son, and my father was entitled to two pouches a year. Pouch means, if you're a diplomat, you have some goodies coming from your home, from the Philippines in this case, twice a year. So they have two things from the government, two or three things that they steadily send, and then some that they don't. One of those things that they steadily sent was a case of hard liquor. Twice a year they sent my dad, the government of the Philippines, because my dad was a diplomat of the Philippines, sent him, among other things, in the pouch, a case at least of hard liquor. My dad doesn't drink. My father's friends know when this pouch are coming. They drink, so they know. And when the pouch comes twice a year, lo and behold, those people that I've never seen before start visiting my dad, you know, because they're expecting something from my dad, and that's the drink. And one of those persons was the foreman of South Naknek, Alaska, Marcelino Divina. So Marcelino Divina had been taking, I guess, little gifts from my dad here and there. I don't know how Marcelino and my dad met, but diplomat, my dad gets to know a lot of folks. My older brother actually went there before me in 1965. I went to Las Vegas during the summer, and my older brother went there. He told me about it, but he never returned. The next year, I went there in 1966. And after that first year, I was so overwhelmed by the work, I just couldn't believe human beings are supposed to work like that, you know? Over 24 hours a day, like I told Katie. One day, July 4th, I was 26 and a half hours, I tallied. So I just couldn't believe it. And me and five other guys took a vow never to return to that goddamn place ever again. And if you see us there, we would give you $100. For 15 years, all six of us came back.
Yeah, I got ready.
All six of us came back. Not one of them, not one of us did not return. So it's always been a challenge and a mystery to find out why it is, what it is that makes people keep coming back. And when they get there, they're not really too crazy about it, you know. But then, like the salmon, I figured, like the fish, by April, I feel it already. You know, I feel my friends start calling me, are you going to go out this year? Are you going to, who's going to be there? Did you, did you hear so-and-so died when he was there? So all these things. So every year, I would hear this, and I would hear it around April. And I knew that I wasn't going to miss that year again. So 15 times it happened.
So what did Marcelino tell you about Alaska and about South Naknek?
He said, that's no man's land, son. You go there, you know, who gives a shit about you, okay? You go there, you got a job to do, you don't do it, people are gonna kick your ass. So you're gonna go there, it's no man's land. Make sure you cannot go there if you're an individualist, because this is what he was trying to tell me. Not in so much words, but I figured there was a community there that you really have to function within, or else you will hang up the whole thing, hang up the production, as they say. And because we were Filipinos and we were the key to the whole cannery because of the fish house. The fish house is the key to the whole cannery. You mess up on the fish house, forget it. You can't do anything else. I mean, you can't can fucked up food. You can't cook it. The fish house got to do, and they get paid 50 bucks extra a month or an hour or something. So without the fish house butchers, they call them, the whole cannery would fall apart. And only Filipinos can do that. I don't know why. There's another project for research, but we struck one time, twice. We didn't go to work. And people from the fish house, not even noontime yet, the whole operation couldn't work, couldn't operate, couldn't go on. So the fish house, very important. And when the Filipinos were taken out, they tried to put the Indians there, the American Indians, the white folks, they couldn't get with them. You need rhythm, you need a lot of stuff for that. Camaraderie, it's kind of, as my boss Marcelino Divina said, you know, because he was showing this rookie around, this rookie the first time, and the guy was looking at one guy operate, do the machine, fast. That was almost like his course was closed. It was like this. Then Marcelino turned to the rookie guy and said, you see, technique. You need technique, or else you're going to be doing that the whole 20 hours. You need left and right, you're up and down. You can't tired one night, you just got to, you need technique. So that's when I found out that to last a long time, you do need some kind of system in your work, in your physical work. I was doing four man's job one time. I was piling the coolers. I was by myself. You know, I was piling them three high. You know, and about 15 length long. And I would get on top, put it in, go down. So I knew how to do it. But then I was young. When you're young, you can do anything, I guess.
How old were you the first summer?
21.
And so even though Marcelino told you that it was going to be really hard work and exhausting, mm-hmm. and no man's land, what was the allure? Why did you want to go?
The people and the place. You know, the people, all my cannery workers are different. Not that they were great people. It's just the camaraderie and the singing. But it was tense. You know, it wasn't really idealistic and you can go there and just relax. No, it was tense because it was fights. That people get drunk. People are owing money in the gambling. So you always have to have a role to play. What was your question? I was going to get to.
What was the allure? If you knew it was going to be so hard and he warned you,
yes.
Why did you want to do it?
Well, the chemistry between the working people. You know, I didn't know it was going to be such a pull. And the second one is the place itself, South Nacdec. You know, the place is in the middle of nowhere. You know, but not really, because you learn a lot when you're there for a long time. You work, and then when you're not working, you walk around the place, the canneries, you check it out. You learn a lot because even though it's quiet, the place South Nacdec to me spoke in many different languages. You know? Even though the place was a relatively quiet place, even the graveyard had a lot of stories. So I knew that, and then I belonged in that story. You see, that's where I found my voice. All these things happen as a writer, and that's where I really found my voice. Because when you're an artist, you don't know. You just do this, you want to do this. But when I started going to Alaska, and not just Alaska, but people who worked in the fields, you know, people, older folks who are single men. That's when I found that these guys, and I was doing work with them. I was tallying the time cards for five other old-timers, and I figured they didn't know how to read and write. So I was paying for five. To me, all those guys, because I had the wherewithal to write and to my parents somehow got me into a good education, so I really was put in a responsibility. I asked myself a question. I mean, you know, since you can do all these things, you have a responsibility to let the people hear their voices. And since you are gifted with the gift of writing, that's how you have to do it. So I really did, and when I wrote, there were so many different stories there. I liked it so much because there were so many characters, I disappeared. To me, a good storyteller disappears when he tells a story. Most people, they like to be in the story. They like to make the audience know I was there. But to me, one of the signs of a good storyteller is when the listener doesn't even know you're there. It's listening to the different characters you're talking about. And Alaska taught me that.
So had you, before you went up there, had you met other young men, young Filipino men that had been traveling to Alaska, or did you know other Manongs that were cannery workers?
Yes, I did, yeah, because I worked in the farms before Alaska, you know, and that's what I call the followers of the seasons trail. You know, they follow the seasons, they pick fruits, and then when it's June, the elite goes to Alaska, not all. So, and from Alaska, then they go back September and pick falling leaves for grapes. Then they, you know, the whole year they have a certain pattern that follows the seasons. That's why I call them the followers of the seasons. And those in the summer go to Alaska and sometimes stay for the crabbing and the halibut season. I had a friend who was in Alaska 11 months out of the year. We had a joke about him. When he goes home with a suitcase. The wife was waiting for him to welcome him, but she was waiting for him with another suitcase to sort of change suitcase because he's going back again, back to Alaska next year. Yeah.
So you had started then as a fruit picker and then became a
cannery worker. Yeah, and many of the cannery workers also pick fruit. The great Delano strike in 1965, they were mostly from Delano, and Divina, my former, was from Delano. So when they went to Alaska that year, I heard all of them talk, because I knew from all of them before who they were. And I felt that the farm workers' history was being told when they went to Alaska. Because all those actors of the farm workers went to Alaska, most of them. And they were telling each other, remember the time, last time you were there, you were hiding from the cop, you know. So, no, I wasn't hiding, because the cop was there. So they were all denying it, but they were all there. And as a historian and as a writer, I had to sort of reconstruct and capture the truth of that experience. And I figured that's a big part on me. There's nobody else writing it for me, at least for my people. So I felt a deep sense of responsibility to write it. But it was okay with me. I welcomed it.
So, did you join the union that first year?
Yes, I did, yeah.
What was the union?
It was kind of fixed. It was, you know, when one of the, let's say Divina, Marcelino Divina, when they put, because I noticed, when we went to Alaska the first year, three of us, right? Three of us from San Francisco went. My friend Seraphim, he had his own connection in Seattle. His aunt was the ambassador from Seattle. Sulit was her name. Then my friend Danny, his uncle went to Alaska a couple of times before, so we were going to stay at his place. And then my uncle, Vincent, who also lived in Seattle. So we all had our connections. And then I also had my foreman, who was my dad's connection. But I didn't think about my foreman because he didn't live there. I thought about my connection, my uncle. And Danny thought about his connection and surfed like him. So we played those for 2 weeks. Nothing was happening, man. Every day we'd go back to the union. We looked like we looked so sorry. Later on, my foreman, Divina, would tell me, man, you were the sorriest looking bunch of guys I've seen. I felt so sorry for you guys. Anyway, so the three of us were waiting and waiting and waiting. And nothing was happening. My friend's connection and my friend Seraphim's connection, Ambassador Sulit, somehow didn't, it fell through. I don't know what happened. My friend Danny's connection, it fell through too. So at the third week, I said, I might as well try my dad's connection. This Divina guy, you know, I'm going to look for that guy, man. I'm going to look. So I went to the union hall. I said, where's Divina here? This is the third week we were there. We've been starving all the time. And they said, that's the guy over there. And, you know, Divina had his arm around somebody else's shoulder, and my friend was saying, look, that's the union fix. He's fixing him up. He's getting him dispatched, and he's giving him bribe, you know. That's how they fix it. So I went to the guy, you know, I just said, the hell with that. I'm going to ask this guy. I said, Mr. Divina, I'm Oscar Peñaranda, Florentino's son. Holy shit, he told me. The guy was so shocked. Are you, you know, Mano means older brother. Are you my Mano so-and-so's son? I said, yeah. Your brother was here last year, he told me. He worked for me. I said, yeah, I know. That's why I'm here this year. The hell, we're leaving tomorrow. Did you just get here? I said, they've been here for 3 weeks. 3 weeks? Oh, that was some shit. Now I got to get you in. We're leaving tomorrow. He said, wait a minute. one of my jitney drivers in jail. I might not bail him out this time, because this is the second time I'm doing it. I let him stay there, okay? You take his place. You are the two friends. Do they have a job already? I said, no, we'll be made. I put him in Peterson Point, but they can't be with you, because we're full. So since then, my two friends came to Naknek the second year, because at least they got in the first year, and that was the beginning of my... And my friend who was a jitney driver, he came to, who was in jail, I took his place in jail. He came 2 weeks later and took his old place as a jitney driver. He was a good jitney driver, but...
So there, that was in Seattle?
Seattle, okay. Yeah, it's in Seattle.
Was it Local 37?
Yes, Main Street, yeah.
So the process then wasn't that you just like put your name on a list. What was the dispatching process back then?
Yeah, the dispatching, as I remember, there were several processes, not just one, I remember. First, if they think you know somebody, so you got connection, you go there and see him, and then they'll tell you to go upstairs and write your name down, and then they'll let you know. That's a bad feeling already, imagine. The other one is they'll write your name down, then you go see somebody, and that somebody will take you for your physical. That's a good sign. Once you get your physical, you might get in. So, in other words, if they tell you wait for a while, you're going to have to wait. If they tell you physical's Monday, that means you're going to get in. So when I talked to Divina and he said, okay, I'm going to get you in, you go get your physical this afternoon, tomorrow we leave, okay? And then you have the two friends, you guys leave next week. So that's how he fixed it. And then somebody else put on the paperwork. But it was all kind of no due process, all different type of things. So there's a lot of crookedness and corruption there.
So what do you think qualified someone to go from the put your name on the list and maybe we'll call you back versus go and get your physical? What was the difference?
Yeah, the closeness of the connections that you had. So if I went there and my father's connection was Divina, and they weren't that close, or it wasn't that strong. Maybe I make an error, but that Divina owed my father, he felt he owed my father something. He'll have to probably get me a job. So it all depends on the feeling of the guy, that how much he owes this guy who had done him a favor before. Pretty much, you'll get in, pretty much. If that happens, if it was me and somebody's son came to me and said, you know, this is so-and-so's son. And I had a positive experience with that guy before, especially if that guy did something to me. I'll do the best I can to put him in. Yeah.
So it sounds like there was lots of competition for the jobs.
Yeah.
Why?
Yeah. Why what? Why?
Why was there competition for the jobs, do you think?
Like I said, most of them are working in the farms, right? Not everybody in the farm can go to Alaska. It's only a few of them. So while you're working on the farm, the people who are the contractors, I guess, the contractors, the people who's going to hire you, check you out that you work. And then if you're a pretty good worker, there's a screening involved, at least mental screening. You just don't go to Alaska. You get screened by the person who's going to bring you there. So it's usually a contractor. Probably seen you work on the farm before. And if he's never seen you before, he's only trusting on the guy who told you to get, then it would depend on how much he feels he owes the guy.
Who was the one that really made the decision about who would go and who would not?
The president, Gene Navarro, was the time was the president, Gene Navarro. And after them, it was Barroso, Tony Barroso. And I stayed at their places both times. And I knew the people too. Later on, when they were involved in the murder, I knew those people too.
What was the job of the foreman?
The foreman
is Marcelino.
Marcelino, okay. Marcelino is, to me, a little different from the other foreman, from what I hear from the other cannery workers. The way I see it, the life of the common worker, common Filipino worker at least, depends on the foreman's vision of what the role are. So if a foreman's vision thinks it's his role to keep the boys down disciplined, that's what the foreman's vision is, then the workers will know that that's a guy, he's a company guy, we're gonna follow the rules all the time. So what was the question again?
What was the job of the foreman?
Yeah, so the foreman is supposed to control the, just speaking of Marcelino Divina, there was also the Jimmy Walker. I don't know if you guys know about Jimmy Walker, the Indian foreman, the native foreman. And then there's the Japanese foreman. There's three of them, three short guys. They picked my bench in the Laiwash to bullshit all day and to say, Oscar, listen to what, this is where all the decisions are made. They're all 5-footers and their feet not even touching the ground. They're going like this. Anyways, what was I saying? Well, I got
about the jobs of the foreman.
Yeah, so they all had two different jobs. The job of Marcelino was to make sure that the Filipinos get the job done when the superintendent wants the job. So the superintendent will tell Marcelino, you know, I want the schoolers moved tomorrow. But he probably doesn't have to tell Marcelino. Marcelino will know. But anyways, and then he said that so some ships are coming in. So the foreman will tell it to Divina. Divina will tell it to me, and then I'll tell it to the younger guys. Probably just me, I think. Just me and Divina. There's one or two guys who were more knowledgeable than I was, but they didn't have the charisma with the other, the youth, because I was young. I was just like all of them. And when I told them, when they had a complaint, they would come to me. They would come to me. And I was getting tired of it. I would like to escape and see my Indian friends. But then there would all be, see, once you get a complaint in, you know, the other guy was going to start complaining. So then I had to, that's why I became the delegate in a few years. Because they were doing it, I was doing it anyways. I was doing all that stuff anyways. And you said the role?
The foreman.
Yeah. So Marcelino's role was to make sure our job is done. In fact, I heard him say all the time to any kind of farmer or anybody. He would tell, you know, just tell me what they need to do. I'll make sure they do it. I don't want you to tell them what to do. I will tell them. And all the superintendents, they sort of do that. You know? They had a pretty good rapport with the Divina. There was only one or two that went. They also had a foreman. The cannery had also a foreman, but he wasn't a foreman to us, but that's a cannery foreman, so technically he could tell us what to do, but he says that Divina probably told him, be better if I told him, but then sometimes, can't do that all the time, if something's happening, the white foreman would tell the Filipino guy, get the hell out of there, and the Filipino guy would complain to me, and say, you know, that guy, he told me, that I would talk to the guy. There was only one guy who was one foreman, and that was his name was Johnson too, but not his Johnson. I think his name was Chris Johnson.
Or Jim?
Yeah, not his Jim. There was three Johnson at the time, three or four. One was a beautiful a woman too. Everybody was pretending to have coffee around her, and but they were just trying to take her out after mug up time. But anyways, she was a Johnson too. I remember three Johnson, and I overheard my Divina tell the other Johnson, yeah, you know that's Oscar there, you know what the Chris Johnson told me about him? He said, who is that fucking intellectual asshole that's talking? Because I guess I was quoting some label Ross, they couldn't just tell people, you know, put the hairnet and all this other, I was telling them all this stuff. We didn't really want to father obeying all those things. But I was sort of insisting on one or two things, not all of them, especially the long hair. Because they would say, Oscar, man, these guys, even the white guys would come to me, because they were in local 37 too. I used to play basketball over there, would come to me and say, you know, this guy, well, cut my fucking hair, right? What's he got? I said, as long as you got the hairnet on, you don't need to cut your hair. That was a big deal in those days.
So, when you
first arrived at South Naknek, what was your impression? It was like in the middle of nowhere. Yeah, it was like in the middle of, I saw some remnants of some towns, but I couldn't see really a town, but I saw some buildings there. I saw like a school and then the cannery. So it was the cannery that really, the cannery's presence that was that loomed over the whole area to me. Because nothing was really happening until we got to the cannery, and then they showed us the bunkhouse. And then I got to be friends with the people of South Nakhne. I still am. I got a hold of the gym. I had the key to the gym. I ran the school there too, because I was a teacher anyways, So every time we were off, I would have the key to the gym. Me and all the white guys and all the people, even the girls who play basketball. It was nice to see. And then the village people who owned the gym, they loved it. And I said, oh, Oscar's bringing some people there so they get to know some of the local people. They loved it, yeah. And then the thing, I started bullshitting them. When people start looking up to you, pretty soon you start believing them. I told them, yeah, I'm an NBA player. I used to play, and all of a sudden, so now, when I left, they thought I was playing for the Lakers or something, but I didn't deny it.
So, what was your job?
The first one, technically, because the jitney driver was in jail, I was a jitney driver. Then after about a week, the guy came, I became a cooler supplier. For the first couple of years, I was a cooler man.
And what's that?
The cans of salmon that are not cooked yet are going to be put in this big tube, about 6 foot wide tube, the retort, big one. And to be put there, these cans need to be put on a strip of about 1 yard square of strips of steel or iron. And they put the can there, whether it's 1 pound can or 1/4 pound or 1/2 pound. 1 pound would be the easiest one to do, half and the quarters are naturally harder because they scatter all over the place. But 1 pound and seven high, you stack them seven high, seven coolers high, then you slide them down the rail and wait for seven more. And that's the cooler supply. And make sure, and we and my partner, only two of us, make sure that those coolers never run out because it will stop the production of canning the fish.
And so you would move them from you fill one retort and then move on to the next retort?
The can would come to the retort just. Other people put them in the retort. The Indians put them in the retort. No Filipinos put them. Indians. I don't know how they work with the union. I guess that's their thing. And the Indians in the retort, and I would be, about from here to that pole, right? About 10 yards. And that's when I knew that the Indians are really good in sign languages. It's not stereotype. They're really good. I used to see them there. And they would have to communicate with me all the noise. If there was a hang up, I'd see him. What's the matter? What's hanging it up? I'm seeing that. One time I saw him over there, And he did all his job already. His name is Red Cap, Indian guy. He looked at me. And he saw me and my partner bullshitting, talking. So he looked at me again and said, he was working. You? No. Just talking. And that's another way to sort of communicate. It's good because it's noisy anyway. You can't talk, you can't hear anything. So you need to do some kind of communication. I'm never good at it.
So you noted that the people that were filling the retorts were natives.
Yeah.
But what were other jobs that, where was the purview of the Filipino crew versus jobs that were non-Filipino? Where did that line seem to be?
Mm.
Did it shift or was it pretty strict?
It was pretty strict. I don't know how it happened in the beginning, but machinists, Filipinos, no machinists. Cooks, I was involved in a strike because of two cooks one time. Cooks, no Filipinos, but they have a higher pay, cook in the state. I think one time, 2 or 3 days, the old men were complaining to me and said, I'm not going to go to work tomorrow. Fuck that goddamn cook. I don't know who's cooking the rice, but he doesn't know how to cook it right, he said. I said, what's wrong with it? They said it's too watery. It's not, or too dry. I don't know. They didn't know what to do. So I told I think his name was Johnson. I don't know which one. I told Johnson, you know, this guy's here. Can't eat the rice, you know. I told him they work. I told him they work really hard. But you got to feed them well. If they don't like what they eat, they're not going to work. I mean it. I said, you know, I don't even have to work, tell them to go to psych. They're not going to work. They didn't believe me. So the next day, because they couldn't cook the rice, you know, I said, you know, we can solve this. You know, why don't you get two of my the Filipino workers who are working on the guy, give them the cook's pay just for that day or for the several days that we did. We have to give them the cook's pay because they're the ones that's going to cook it. I can't tell them to go there and then pay them the same, you know. So they said no. The next day we struck. Not even noontime. The whole thing fell apart. So the stew, they gave two of the Filipinos to cook rice, cook's pay. So that was good, two of them. And then the Filipinos were saying, good, give them those two cooks because they're the lousiest cooks we have anyway. Because then the other cooks will cook the Filipino food for us. You know, when we have the party at end of the season, most of the four or five cooks go together and they cook, oh, hell of a menu. And those are the ones, they pick stuff from the ground. I don't know what it is, some herbs. And they put it in their...
So the mess hall before, even though there were white cooks that could cook the rice, and then there were Filipino cooks, were the mess halls segregated before then?
Yeah.
So the white cooks would like bring food over to the Filipino mess hall, or how did that work?
Yeah. I don't know. The white cooks stayed in the kitchen. I think some of the Filipino men brought the food to the tables. I think some of us brought food in. The foreman and the second foreman, because our second foreman, he always made sure. And then what was the question? So the one that brought the food, I think were Filipinos too. I don't think the cooks left their thing.
But there were segregated mess halls, even though there was one kitchen.
Yeah, so it's a big kitchen like this. So the first half of the kitchen would be the Italians. And then the second half would be the Filipinos, and then across would be the natives. I don't know whether the white folks were there or did they had their own. I think they had their own little kitchen too. The white workers, but many of the white workers, not many, because I think two or three, even though all of them wanted to eat with us because we had good food. We ordered from Chinatown, Seattle, and brought the food there, frozen, you know, mushroom and everything, and they cooked good Chinese, Filipino food. So we had really the good food. And many of the white machinists, there was one, Bernie, I really liked him. We all liked him. When we ate, he ate with us. Man, the guy, if we liked somebody, we always invited him to have food. Never thought like that. It was a good sign of a camaraderie and acceptance, I guess.
Would you have been welcome to eat in the white mess hall?
I was only invited once or twice, yeah.
So it was...
It's called the Blue Room, mm-hmm. Yeah. I was there. And Davina was telling me, I was the first one there or something. I was not protocol to have workers in this Blue Room. Except for me. There's nothing they said that too much importance to me, but it was a time of rockness. I remember rockness. I went one time with somebody else, went a couple of times. Usually it's good because the administration, they try to handle it. It's just that sometimes the Filipinos and maybe the Native Americans, they had a lot of stuff inside, and they couldn't articulate it, and they just said, fuck it. You know? So I didn't want to, as long as I was there, I didn't want them to feel like that. You know? I wanted them to feel like if they had something to say, they should be able to say it, and I could help them say it, and see what the administration would have to say.
So the mess hall then, where you would eat, there was a section within the same room for Italians, a section for Filipinos, a section for Natives.
Yes.
Where would the fishermen eat?
Different, yeah. They wouldn't eat there. Yeah.
Okay.
But the Italians, they're all fishermen there. So the Italian fishermen would be, but not the company fishermen who are white, and the natives, they would eat with us too. They had their own, the native cannery worker, that's a different one too. The native fisherman, that's a different thing. I don't know what the native fishermen ate. Maybe they ate on their own. I don't know if they worked for the company. Some native fishermen worked for the company, some worked for themselves. Yeah.
So that first summer after you left, how did you feel at the end of the season?
Boy, I, like I said, the work was devastating. It was hard work, but it was really the lack of sleep that was the toughest, especially for young men who really love to sleep. It's just unbelievable how people could do that, but I did it, you know. And then the next, after the first year, I was going to go again. You know, after the first year, I was going to go again the second year. And there were so many things. Well, I guess it's like any other. I was a writer too. I'm an artist. So when I was there the first year, I wrote a lot. You know? First few years, I wrote a lot. So it was also conducive to my writing. But like I said, I found my voice too when I started going there. So it was both favorable for me as much as it was for the people, for the workers I was with. Me as a writer and as a teacher, it was also this time during Vietnam, crazy time. One of the times I was in Alaska was when the Palestinian field, 17 Jewish Olympics. Oh, crazy times. Around the summertime, all this happened at the time. So the conflict between administration and the workers sometimes was a conflict of age, you know, old people and the young people. They saw us as a young hippie, counterculture folks, and they were the traditional things that were keep these long-haired people, you know. That's usual, you know, some of the old folks thought it was just a trend. But it was happening all over the world, you know. So ethnic studies was born during the universities. I was also part of the ethnic studies while I was going to Alaska. In fact, I got my job teaching in San Francisco State University when I was 24, while I was in Alaska. I was involved in this strike here, the ethnic studies strike. We had 15 demands from October, November, December, the next year, January, February, March, about 5 to 6 months, closed the school down. But we were in the school every day, rallying and all. So after that, we got our demand. I went to Alaska. Well, I was in Alaska, telegramming, saying that when you come back, we need a teacher. You're the only one that has a master's, one of the few, so to teach. So when I came back, I wrote up the courses. Until now, I think 75% of the Filipino-American studies of San Francisco State, I wrote when I was in my 20s.
Did your work in Alaska or as a migrant worker in the field impact that curriculum?
Yeah, I was kind of hesitant to write my own works as part of the curriculum, but I told them that anybody who wrote about Alaska should, and I would always give them one of my things. But I made sure that experience was an experience that's well worth writing about, even if they didn't read any of my works.
Can you tell me about how was it that the union functioned? Like, would they take dues out of your paycheck?
Yes, yeah. Yeah, they took dues automatically, and not only that, but by the time when the Alasqueros, we were called Alasqueros, when the Alasqueros came back from Alaska to Seattle, not only did we have to pay dues, we had to pay donations. We were forced to make donations to the different Filipino-American clubs that were in Seattle. You know, here's the ladies' club here. Oh, they're right, line up. If we pick up our check here before we leave the hall, there's three or four tables we got to oh, here's for the ladies' thing, here's for the thing. Okay, then you go. So that's how some of the collections were done. Yeah.
Did the union send up people for gambling purposes? I mean, was there?
It was gambling all the time. My cannery anyway, and I'm pretty sure in all the canneries it was gambling. And to make things worse, in my cannery, it was my foreman who was the one who ran the gambling. I don't know about, I guess in all the other canneries, the foreman has to have some kind of thing. But, you know, it was not a good thing. I heard a lot of the boys complain to me, I don't know how much percentage he takes, like this, like that, you know. So I'm a gambler too. And I said, you know, you guys, if there was a dice table, that's really the only way you can get some money back. Because the way, if you play blackjack, if you play rummy, play all this stuff, all the percentage will go to the house. If you play dice, 3% will only go to the house. Because I researched it. So I told him how to play dice. Until, and I was the one who ran it. So I would run it. If the guy was losing, I would run it till he gets his money back. Then I would close it. Because I'd see the two big losers. I don't want it to be big losers because they're going to stab, they're going to beat somebody up. They don't give a shit anymore. After they lose all their paycheck and then they still have a month to work, you think he's going to be a good boy? I didn't want that to happen. And I know that happened to many of them before. So I would wait till he makes his money back. I saw two or three, they lost it already. Oh, $2,000. First night. And I ran it, I let him run it till they got it back, then I closed the table.
What were the favorite games?
Palal, they call it Pai Gao here. Pai Gao is Pai Haikyu over there. They have several names for it, but it's the tile that they use as cards. Then it's some kind of rummy game. That's it.
And what were the dice games that you played?
The dice, the way I played in the casino, they made the dice. You know, those guys are geniuses. You know those workers? They're little rooms, and then they have, you know, me, I'm a slob. You know, I don't give a shit. But they're little rooms, they take so much pride in it. You know, they put little decorations here. They take the wheel of the wires and make a table out of it. You know, maybe. To me, I don't know, I just had to take pride in, because I was so poor at it, I just admired that in them.
And in there they would do the gambling?
No, the gambling is in the lobby, yeah.
In the bunkhouse or in the rec hall?
The rec hall. So the bunkhouse had a, no, not a rec hall, the bunkhouse had a lobby, and that's where they did the gambling. They didn't do gambling in the rec hall. They didn't own in their own bunkhouse.
So, did you sense that this kind of gambling part of the cannery work is something that had been around for a long time?
Oh yeah, yeah.
Was it part of the system in a way? Like.
Yeah, I think that, you know, when you have people who are kind of at the bottom of the social status, gambling will always be a part, because that's a dreamer's, that's a dream. You know, gambling is for dreamers, you know. And
do you know how long Divino had been going to
Knack Knack? Quite a while, because I was the number one listener of Divina, of Jimmy Walker, the Native American, and of Willie, the Japanese one. The Jimmy Walker, oh, Oscar, come here. Of course, I'd sit there. I don't want to work, you know. I'd rather sit there and listen to them. And I remember they would. We'd talk, and then I'd do something else. Then I'd come back, right? And Divino would say, come on, sit down over here. We're in 1923, what happened? So people were telling me, so he said, since the 1920s. So Divino must have been there, I don't know, quite early, man.
So he was pretty old when he was the foreman then, huh?
Yeah, he was old. He was, I remember, 54 or 56. We were telling each other that. Now I was 21, so.
What did you learn about the early history of Alasqueros or about South Knack Knack through those conversations?
Well, I learned the importance of that industry. I learned that we virtually supplied the world. That Bristol Bay is a gold mine of salmon. All kinds of ships were there from all over the world. And little by little, I would learn. Is this the only place in Alaska where they go to? And I learned later on that there are other places they go to, but Bristol Bay, it's got to be one of the prime places that all the international boats go to get to Alaska. And to me, it became central, a central for a global industry. And I was right in the middle of it. And people, it's happening right under people's noses, and they don't even see it as history. And that's why I'm glad you guys brought this up to their attention. See?
Were there conflicts between the younger Filipino Americans and Filipinos and the Manong generation?
Yes.
What sort of conflicts?
There's several kinds. There's the conflict in Seattle, which led to the murder, because in Seattle was the Union Hall, and that's where the power of the Union is. And the Union was doing it the old school way, you fix you up like this. And the younger folks were complaining that, not just the younger folks, not so much the younger folks, but the younger Filipino-American folks. The older Filipino folks have been here, and the younger Filipino-American folks, their politics, because of the way things were, the unions were being run, the younger ones didn't want this fixing up. They wanted to be, to be on the level, and they saw that's corruption and all that stuff. And so they played their cards like that and divided the two. Now, to me, that's why some of the murders happened. But, I wasn't really paying attention to it when I was in Alaska, back and forth. But if I knew it was coming, like I said, I knew both of them before, I could have done something then, because the Filipino-Americans who were in the Union and the Filipino old-timers who were in the Union did not understand each other. They did not see. There was a barrier between them. One was language. I can speak both languages. If they, the Filipino-Americans, the young ones, because they won in their election. In the election, the old ones lost two important seats. The younger ones won two. And then the younger ones are going to threaten to win some more. But to me, I could have, get a bicultural, bilingual person like me, and then let them talk. That's what we're there for. That's why there are people like me, so you can maybe talk to. Because to me, the Filipino Americans who was murdered and their cohort, they were friends of mine, Gene Viernes, but I knew them too, and I knew the hearts of the old folks. You got to talk to them. If you want change like that, to me, you have to talk to them. You got to let them know. Talk every day. You just don't tell them, fuck you, man. You're going to go that way. I'm going to go this way. You do that, then you'll never... You see what happens? Right? The younger folks underestimated the older folks. They're crazy. They underestimated. They were there in the Union Hall. No protection. The guy comes in the afternoon and shoots both of them. That's naivete to me. If they knew those old folks weren't playing games, they wouldn't do that. They would have talked to someone like me, and they would try to prevent that stuff. But that's a tragedy. It's no good.
You noted that there were two conflicts. What was the other conflict between the Manongs and the younger generation?
That's the two cultural, the Filipino American and the Filipino one. Now, the Manongs and the younger generation. That's what I was telling. The conflict was on. What did you?
You said that there were two conflicts.
Yeah, that's the one. That's the one I mentioned, right?
Well,
which one is the, which one did I mention?
You mentioned Gene Viernes and Sylvie Domingo.
Mm-hmm.
Were there any other that you noted between the younger generation and the older generation at the cannery?
Yeah, quite a few. But the younger generation went through it by the book, so that they went to the election, they filled out the forms, they did all that stuff. Even though I heard other complaints for younger generations, they didn't follow up the way Gene Viernes and did. So I heard complaints about and conflict between the old folks and the young folks, but they didn't really follow up on it. But one of the conflicts besides that, the old folks, is that the younger folks, they're not, I was talking about the younger folks too, and the younger Filipino-American and the younger Filipino-Filipino. That's the other conflict I was telling you about. Because like, so for example, I was 21 when I came. I was bicultural, I speak four languages. But other 21-year-olds were born here. Another 21-year-old were born in Philippines, and they couldn't get through because they're younger. So that's another conflict too. Until now, they don't understand. So Filipino-American and Philippine-Philippine, they don't. That's one of the things I do when I travel there, to make the two collaborate. So when you work together, maybe you can understand each other more, you know.
So did you notice, as time went on, how did you feel about the segregated mess hall and all of that? Mm. I mean, was that something that at first was normal and then became abnormal? Or what was the sense, and how did that change over time at the cannery? Yes. As civil rights became more in the forefront of people's minds?
Yeah, that's a good question. Yeah. Say that again?
How did kind of the budding civil rights consciousness impact what was happening at South Neck Neck? Or did it?
Yeah, it did. You framed it another way before. I was gonna, how did you frame it the first time? Say it again.
How did you perceive it, that shift over time as civil rights became something in the national consciousness and the impact that was happening at South Macro?
Mm. I don't understand the question again. Just say that again.
As time went on, because you were there in the early 60s through the 70s.
Yeah, correct.
And
yeah.
At that time, of course, this is like you were saying, how the ethnic studies program started. Yeah. And general civil rights is an important issue.
Yeah.
How did that impact what was happening in NACNEC? Or did it? Or not at all?
Oh, yeah, it did. It did. In the 70s, maybe 75, more women, more white women started coming in. So white guys too, college age. You know, maybe the sons and daughters of the staff, the administrative staff. But more white folks started coming in, and they were at the college level. And that was 70. I don't know exactly what happened, but before that there were hardly any women. After that there were quite a few. And that was part, to me, it was part of the impact of the civil rights and all that stuff. That was part of the result of it. And I kind of liked it that the women were there, besides just the balance of the sexes. But as a writer, I get tired of one sex. I like to observe different sexes. I like to observe different sexes so I can write about it. And when there's... when the women were not there, it was, it was like we were pretending in the same place. It's like when the women came, they sort of reminded us of reality of life. Reality of work, and you don't have to get drunk so much all the time. And some of the women were our aunties. They were not just there for us to chase around sexually. Some were there to make sure that family values were still around. So it was a refreshing thing. So one time before the women came, we had a nurse. The nurse came. Well, everybody was so... We didn't know what to do. It was a woman coming in. She was about, I don't know, 60-something years old. Black woman, but to us, man, just the touch of the hand, the arm, I don't know what it was, but it made us okay again. For everybody got sick, by the way. Everybody had some kind of sickness.
So were the bunkhouses segregated, so it was like Filipinos in one and Natives in another, or was it mixed at all? How are people assigned to bunkhouses?
Yeah, we're
sorry to interrupt, but we are closing this section.